from 2005, I think.
2004.
2004. And she had put our archives on a very strong footing and has given us glimpses of TIFR's past, with all many such exhibitions that she had put up in TIFR, throughout TIFR. And today she will be talking about a topic which has come out of her research in of the TIFR, setting up the TIFR archives. And she has been working on this for a long time and has written this book, which is called Growing the Tree of Science, Homi Bhabha and Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, which was published last year. And the book is actually available outside, outside the hall. This is not her first book on Homi Bhabha. She has earlier written a book with Ananya Dasgupta on Homi Bhabha also a few years ago. And just a few words about Indira herself. She's a founder director of the Center for Public History at Srishti Institute in Bangalore. Srishti Institute of Art, Design and Technology at Bangalore. She was formerly a professor of English in Jadavpur University. And she was also the founder of the Archival Resources of for a Contemporary History in Bangalore. And she has a PhD in history from School of Oriental and African Studies in London University. So she has had both literature training and work experience in history and archival research. So we look forward to the treat that she's going to give us today about you know, how the history of the institute went back and how an institution like this could grow in India.
Thank you, Alok, for that very generous introduction. This is really a pleasure to be back, because I remember in 2002 visiting here for the first time and coming with great confidence from Bangalore, thinking I will find the place. And I couldn't find the place. I got taken to Tata Hospital because nobody knew what the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research was. And I was so confident that I could just find it by telling the taxi to bring me here. I learned later that you had to say Navy Nagar, you had to say, you know, where exactly it was, and people didn't necessarily still remember it. So that was a lesson for me that, you know, maybe I'm coming with a set of expectations about its past, and at present, do people in Bombay really know it? But it was a great pleasure to set up the archives today. I spent some time in the archives, and I can see Vrinda here, who helped me set it up, and she now heads the Godrej Archives. Ananya, with whom I wrote the Bhabha book. So I'm very happy that you're all here. And I remember when we were given that material, which makes up your archive today. It was, you know, from the dean's office that we found all those files that related to Bhabha's time here. And we carefully archived them. We got photographs from the photography section. And I hope now, as I take you through, you'll enjoy some of these moments. But I think the topic that I want to speak about is the predicament of legacy, especially when you have a founder who fills the horizon, as it were. What do you do with that kind of a founder? Do you worship him, which I found was the case? Or do you also find ways of understanding what is it that he wanted to do? How do we reinterpret that legacy? How do we take things ahead? So I hope end of this talk there'll be some things to think about, especially when we talk about science and legacy. Because as a historian, I found that there is so much of hagiography of science, that, you know, scientists are turned into these, you know, huge figures about whom there's only praise and there's very little critical understanding of what those figures did. Well, I'm going to begin by reading you excerpts from my notebooks, which belong to 2008-2010, and this is also in my book. They're little excerpts from my notebook. So this is 2008 to 2010. I'm going to refer to the biology lab of my friend Veronica Rodriguez, to whom this book is also dedicated. I'm sitting in one of the biology labs at TIFR checking email when I wait for my biologist friend to emerge from a meeting. The two young women in lab coats are engaged in a furtive conversation. She has told us a million times about not keeping lab notes on loose sheets. She's going to scream at you for not filling up your lab notebook. It's better to say that you made a mistake than to lie, and don't pretend that you didn't know about this. She's going to find out anyway. The snatch of conversation demonstrates the PI's total control over her lab. It also tells me how norms of science are learnt. Back in Bangalore, my scientist friend from TIFR calls me to ask if I would read Manu Joseph's Serious Men and tell her the characters I recognized in the novel. It is not a strange request, because the novel is apparently set at the Institute, thinly disguised as the Institute of Theory and Research, Mumbai. After I have read the novel, I tell her the characters are unrecognizable for their caricatures, cardboard figures parading as scientists. Only the bare-bone description of the building rings true, and a few depictions of the general atmosphere seems accurate. I read out a passage to her that I think is credible. He sat on the black rock and told the sea his version of the universe. A group of young doctoral students were gathered at a distance. They threw cautious looks at him. It was a tradition here to accept that sometimes men spoke to themselves. My friend laughs. "So you think we are mad scientists?" I tell her, "I have seen perfectly sane scientists walk by the same black rocks talking to themselves." And this was really my experience at TIFR. It was a delight to walk around and see people lost in thought, sometimes talking to themselves, sometimes smiling at the lizard. And I used to always feel that that was work. Work was not always something that happened inside the laboratory. Work also happened as they walked around thinking or talking. So I want to begin, that was my humorous take. So let me begin with a lecture happening right here in 1973. This is Sidney Brenner, and let's see what he has to say.
Part of the course, so they better not fall. She has two roles, let me say. I must inform the students that it is part of the course, so they better not fall asleep here. The second thing is that it is addressed to the public, and I see amongst the public is included people like physicists who don't know anything about biology, and so I'll try to make it simple so that they can understand.
So you can see that this is 73, Brenner is taking a pot shot at the physicists, and this is a physics institute, saying, you know, I'll make it simple so the physicists can understand what biology is about. So I thought, you know, I'll tell you that the archives has a number of things, not just photographs and documents. It has these priceless sound recordings of people who lectured here, sometimes here itself, in the lecture theater, sometimes in the auditorium. And we had digitized all those lectures, and you'll hear a few more speeches. But coming back to the topic today, which is about institutional legacy, I want to start by reminding you that Mary Douglas, who worked on institutions and how institutions function, She said, you know, it is very difficult to go along with the institution and write a critical history of the institution. Because what happens is institutions systematically direct individual memory and channel our perceptions into forms compatible with the relations they authorize. They fix processes that are essentially dynamic, they hide their influence, and they rouse our emotions to a standardized pitch on standardized issues. And to all this, that they endow themselves with rightness and send their mutual corroboration cascading through all the levels of our information system. No wonder they easily recruit us into joining their narcissistic self-contemplation. So institutions are narcissistic, and they will say things that are, you know, compatible with that self-image. So when I came into TIFR, the old exhibition was still there. And the old exhibition had this larger-than-life image of Homi Bhabha saying what a talented person he was. And, you know, this is a loss that the world will mourn. I am a great admirer of Homi Bhabha, so make no mistake. But when I was looking at this, it struck me that that eulogy to him that was there in the institute was really, as I found out when I set up the archives, it was set up in 1967, barely a year after he had died in 1966, 24th of January. It was an exhibition that went to the Royal Society, and when it came back, it was put up here. And to me, and I think when Ananya and I did this book on a masterful spirit, Homi Bhabha, we had a whole chapter which was called A World Without Homi Bhabha. And it was about the institute in mourning. The institute mourning its founder's untimely death. And that exhibition was really an indication of what the institute missed at that point. So I cannot, as a historian, say, well, this is true. The institute really is like this. So I think, obviously, I am going to try and look critically at your history. And I'm going to now take you back again to take you through some sound recordings to recount for you the history. As you know, that this institute began not here, but in Kenilworth, which is on Pedder Road. Today, you see the atomic energy housing complex inside that. But that was Kenilworth in 45 was a bungalow that belonged to Bhabha's aunt, and he rented it from her and started his institute there. So what you see here is a blackboard in, I think, the one of the big rooms. And what is interesting about the inauguration of this institute, it begins during the war. And Bhabha just gives a lecture on cosmic ray physics. And that is it. He says, you know, this is the work I do. This work is important. And so, you know, this is why we should have an institute. So you see that there is Sir Sohrab Saklatwala, who he convinced that this, that the Tata should give money for this. Now, the reason why he has support. I mean, firstly, the reason why he's in India is that he's come in 1939 for a holiday, and he is stuck in India because he cannot go back. The war has broken out. And of course, if I go by the literature that is produced around Homi Bhabha, usually you're told that he was so patriotic, he came to India and he immediately realized that, you know, this was a place where he should really invest his energies. That was just not true. 39, 40, 41, 42, even 43, he wants to go and work with Millikan. He wants to go to America. He wants to go back to England. He wants to go to Europe. He says, I haven't talked science to anybody for a long time. What can I do? And of course, they say, you know, we are completely busy with the war effort. There is no job for you. But around 44, something else happens. Bhabha gets the Adams Prize he also becomes a fellow of the Royal Society. And suddenly, I think to him, it becomes clear that, you know, independence is round the corner and things become possible for science. There is also this realization within the Tata Trust as well as the Parsi community that here is a person who should be supported. Bhabha at that time was already a professor at Indian Institute of Science. He was first a reader, then a professor, and he was supported there by the Tata Trust. But when he starts looking for funds, it is a conversation with J.R.D. Tata that I will play to you in a while, which actually prompts him to write this letter to the Tata Trust, and Sir Sohrab needs to be convinced. The institute moves in 1949 to the old yacht club, where I think the archives was for a brief period. And then this is the foundation stone laying ceremony. And most of you know these pictures because they are there in that exhibition. But do you know this voice? And do you know who is speaking?
A year ago, Dr. Bhabha and I were working on the plan for the development of a fundamental research laboratory for nuclear physics. The problem which perplexed us was whether we could afford to have a separate institute for nuclear studies or expand the Tata Fundamental Research Institute.
This is Bhatnagar, but I often like to ask this question of young scientists who often don't know that this is the man we are talking about. And that is his voice. Because Bhatnagar is all but forgotten today, even though there are awards annually given in his name. And then let's listen to Bhabha himself talking about a letter he wrote to J.R.D. Tata.
Sorry. While I was working as a professor at the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore, that I noted that there was no institute in India devoted solely to fundamental research. Accordingly, in a letter dated the 19th August 1943 from Bangalore, I wrote to Mr. Tata pointing out the lack of proper conditions and intelligent financial support hampers the growth and development of science in India at the pace which the challenge in the country would want.
Now, this letter is something we didn't find in the archives, 19th August 1943. But there is another letter, and I'll read out bits of it, that he writes to his friend Rustam Choksi, J.D. is the older brother, R.D. Choksi, asking that what is the right way in which I can approach the Tata Trust. And Rustam Choksi then writes back to him in February 44, telling him this is the lie of the land. The bread, as you know by now, was well and truly delivered, which means the letter. Turning to lesser things, I think you should now submit a scheme to the trustees, send it along with a letter to Sir SDS, in which you may suggest it is for his consideration, that you would have liked to put it to him in person, and that I'd written to you to send on the scheme. You'd be glad of any suggestions, modifications, etc. Pile it on a bit. If he felt it could be submitted to his colleagues, he would do so, please. Point it out in an expression of work in hand. Suggest that trustees need not commit themselves for more than 5 years. Hint that it may be later joint effort of trust, board of science and industrial development, and university. Your letter should be personal. Address the scheme to the chairman, Sir Dorab Tata Trust. Better still, though it may waste time, send the scheme as a draft only and say that you will send it formally to him when you've received his opinion. So, you know, this, I think, you know, all of us when we write grants, we look for someone who will give you that kind of advice. And Rustam Choksi is the person who gives Bhabha this advice. I would urge, keep the total of recurring expenditure at don't be shocked at this amount, but this is 44, so it's a large amount, 42,000 per year. It will grow. You will, of course, enlarge as you think fit from the need for such research, point out Bombay's backwardness, deep water experiments, and all else that's cogent. Suggest you don't name it or call it an institute for the present. Institute sounds too big to some. Raise also the question of cost and transfer of present equipment and housing. Wonder if you can bring in Ratan Tata Trust for that. We'll see what JDC says. JDC is his brother, J.D. Choksi, Jal Choksi, who was a lawyer to the trust. On page 4 are more suggestions. There are no more than that. You know best. I feel that something low in the 40s will not mean heartthrobs. Don't sketch the cost for the next year and the next. They ought to know that everything grows. And further on, he says, I think you'll understand that I'm not directing just how you should shape it. May add that all are well aware that you're something unusual to be proud of and something should be done. So these are already discussions, and you find that he has the ear of J.D. Choksi, of Rustam Choksi, and Choksi obviously wants this proposal to go through. And it is Choksi who will now change in the trust what philanthropy and what public private partnership should mean. He says so far the trust has only supported people who are ill or people who are in some distress and given occasional funding. Now we should support to the hilt this young man who wants to open a, start an institution. So it is very unusual. They redefine what charitable work should be, because they start saying this way we'll help one person but build many others. This is the completed building, as you all know, and this is the lone tabubia tree that you all are familiar with. And as we interviewed people, as I interviewed people, a lot of people would talk about this as a metaphor for Bhabha's way of growing science, that grow it around one individual, just as this lawn is organized around that one tree and the rest is empty and it organizes itself in a certain way. I don't know if that was intentional, but I think that is what he wanted to do. Now, this is again from the same inaugural day in 62, and you find that this is Rustam Choksi. You finally see him, J.R.D. Tata, Bhabha and Nehru. And here I think there should be a word about Nehru or how we understand Nehru's interest in science. It is not enough to say that he is interested in science, but Nehruvian science, as David Arnold, who's written on this, talks about, is really something more than just doing science, because he sees science as a philosophical and almost a literary pursuit. And it creates a space for post-colonial ownership and subjectivity, establishing the centrality of science in the autobiography of the Indian nation. Second, since science stood for authority and a higher form of knowledge, Nehruvian science sought to contest Western presumptions of a monopoly over science and to ground modern science in India's cultural traditions and contribution to world civilization. Third, while extolling the transnational foundations of modern science, Nehru understood science intellectually and functionally, primarily in relation to India's national needs and Cold War ambitions. Fourth, Nehruvian science presented science as a program of delivery, committed to redressing such basic social problems as ill health and poverty, an endeavor answerable to the state and the public it aspired to represent. Now, those last things have become very problematic now, because science has not been answerable to the public for a very, very long time. And this, I think, is David Arnold's way of showing what was Nehru's understanding of, what science can do. I'll come now to Bhabha's last speech in order to make a simple point. This is his last speech, the speech he makes before he dies. He is not aware this is his last speech. There is an ICSU conference here in TIFR, but TIFR auditorium is not there. This is a very big conference and it happens in Birla Hall. And science and the problems of development is the speech he makes there. And he talks about how unique TIFR was because TIFR tries to support ability where it is found. It does not advertise. It does not try to, say there are so many posts and now let's fill up those posts. Because he says that science in India is still in its infancy and the number of valuable scientists are very limited. If you try to put them all into one institute, you'll suffer. Therefore, when you find someone, employ him. He also says that, this results in an outstanding scientist being taken away from a university or another research institute, or it results in a mediocre one satisfying the so-called minimum qualifications, being recruited to a post requiring originality, initiative, and leadership. As we all know, the so-called minimum qualifications laid down for a post have little meaning in a research institute and usually results in the floor becoming the ceiling. So I think, he's very clear that, you cannot really go around employing people. So even though A.V. Hill had told him to begin biology in 1944, he doesn't begin it till he finds Obed Siddiqui in the 60s. So there is a long wait. He feels he has to find the right person. Now, having said this, I think I'm going to take a huge jump because I want to now come to this idea of legacy. Someone who has this vision for an institute, how does the institute then remember him? When I first came to TIFR and I went around talking to scientists who belong to that generation, most of them talked to me about the day he died and how shocked they were. And so I said, what did you do? And most of them remembered that Professor Choksi came and they had a memorial, they had a condolence meeting, and they went back to work because that was perceived as the right thing to do, Baba, in the spirit of Baba. And they were really stunned, but they went back to work and they worked. And I think Obed Siddiqui did tell me that they were very uncertain. They didn't know, since Baba had such a direct access to, Delhi, would it be the case that, the institute would not have enough funds? What would happen to the institute? But that was not going to be the case. Baba had already ensured that there would be, funding for the institute. But I think it was stunning because he just died in this air crash. When I came into the archives, this is what I found. This is the Parsi Uthamna ceremony that was held at the bottom of the library stairs there. And I kept wondering, I kept saying that, what is this? What is happening here? And, some of them said, oh yes, of course, we had the Parsi Uthamna ceremony in front of the library. And I said, why? Why did you have it here? Why not in his house? And then I think it was Professor Menon who said, his mother felt that this was the most appropriate place. This was what he had built. And we felt that we wanted to do it for her. So you can see his cousin and his aunt. And these are the priests praying here where we walk every day. And you notice this glass curtain and everyone else sitting there. So I think some people might still be here who might remember this, or at least when I was there, they remembered the ceremony. What struck me then was that for the scientists, this was perhaps a little embarrassing. And this was forgotten till the picture was taken out. Because there is this conflict of science and religion, and they didn't want to acknowledge that there was an essentially religious ceremony that happened here. And it happened for their founder, who was, by all descriptions that I've read, wasn't particularly religious, but it did happen here. So it set me thinking as to, you know, what do institutions remember and what do they forget? Why do they forget some things? And why do they remember certain other things? So the condolence meeting is remembered, but this ceremony is forgotten till the photographs come out. Rustam Choksi, of course, in a letter I found later at the archives, this was his address. He said, what is more fitting than on 26 January, the ceremonial service for him should be held in his own institute, in that temple that he had built for other worship. There, amid the utter serenity and dignity of the long colonnade and the vista of sea and landscape of green lawns and trees, men and women of all faiths could do him their last homage. So, this is again a letter that was just lying in some random file, and it is only from, you know, signatures at the bottom that we guessed this was Rustam Choksi. When we kept asking, and they kept saying that, you know, it was done for Meher Bhai Bhabha, who was Bhabha's mother, I realized again in the archives that she was very involved in things that happened in this institute in the early years. So the workshop staff, a lot of them would remember her. They would go to see her after he died. So in some ways you find that there was a personal connection, which was again not something, as an institution grows older, that institutions want to acknowledge that there are these personal connections that have been there. There are workshop staffs who worked on balloon flights who have told me how she would actually tell Bhabha that, you know, these men haven't eaten. Why don't you give them a break to eat instead of, you know, making them work some more? So in that way, they felt very supported by her. So this is a visit of the Queen of England in 62 to India, to the this is in BARC. And I think, you know, you can see that his mother is also here. And no, this is at the Institute, sorry. So I think, you know, you begin to realize that how much personal connections were also part of the foundational moment of this institute. Why, I raised the question earlier, why institutions remember certain things and forget certain things. That's because institutions do not mechanically reproduce the past. They work the past. And they represent it each time in new but related ways for particular purpose, in particular form, that uses the past to create a certain kind of present and a certain kind of future. And that's why the past is very important for the future. It's often picked up and then said, you know, this is the kind of work we did and this is what we want to do later. So if you look at what is being said in the resolution that TIFR passed on Bhabha's death on 25th January, you notice that his patriotism, which was exemplary, the kind of work he did, unremitting toil, exalted vision, that nobler India in which skill technology in the service of man would give to the lowliest among us the beginnings of a decent life. In other words, notice the year, this is 66. Indochina, Indo-Pakistan, there's so much of war in the air. There's so much uncertainty. Scientists who have lived through that time know the uncertainty. And you find that for an institution then, what it chooses to remember is the patriotism. What it chooses to remember is the way in which this particular man worked towards a decent life for everybody. And so you begin to see how the context begins to shape how certain ways of remembering become important. Now, what happens after this was again something that I was very, very curious about. Not that I found answers as such during my stay, I had to think very hard. From 1966, when Bhabha dies, to about 2007, the Bhabha room, Bhabha's office, is not occupied by any of the directors. Nobody sits there. And of course, you know, there are institutional jokes about, you know, is it haunted, what is happening there, etc. So, of course, when I asked M.G.K. Menon, he in fact said that, that the institute was recovering from the shock of, you know, losing its founder. So, in some ways, he couldn't get himself to sit there. He felt that, he had a conversation and he couldn't sit there in that room. But there was something else that was happening also. You had this photograph, which was in the old exhibition, where you can see several people. Let me point out, there's Nehru, there's Bhabha, that's G.R.D. Tata, and this is, does anyone know who this is? This is K.C. This is K. Chandrasekharan, who just passed away, the mathematician who, in fact, had by 66 left. In 1965, K.C. had left. And many of the mathematicians felt that if anyone could direct this institution, it should be K.C. And, of course, K.C. was not called back. But what we find here is interesting, because you find many of these photographs are there without K.C. In that first exhibition, K.C. is excised from the photograph. This one too, where Nehru is looking at the Ramanujan notebooks, that is the original, where you see K.C. And I think this was a bit of a shock to me, because I walked in and I saw these excised photographs. I didn't know they were excised. Till I started looking at, I think we did an archive board on the Ramanujan notebooks, and then I said, but they're brought by K.C. So what is happening here? There is another kind of clash. Institutional legacies are also about people and their very human clashes. And you find that institutions find ways of saying, we'll not remember him now. And this is what happens. But if I were to look at Casey's role in this institute, you'd find that he actually builds a mathematics group which becomes really very dynamic. And there is one point when I had asked some physicists that, you know, if I look at the publications of the mathematics group, they seem to have done so much. How come from this year to this year, physics does not have as many publications? And there's not a very satisfactory answer. And I think what is happening in the 50s is Bhabha writes his last paper in 1954. Bhabha does not write another paper after that. What happens is that he is looking for a leader. And I think yesterday when I spoke at Homi Bhabha Center, I said that, you know, he looks at different people, Max Born, he looks at Feynman, he keeps writing to them that, will you come and spend some time at the institute? He's not there to really grow that group in the way he'd like to. Even someone who he's trained, like Udgaonkar, is sent off to do reactor physics. And, he's not there to look after the younger ones who then go off to Caltech, go off here and there. So there is a lack of, you know, a second line of leadership in the institute. And you have an administrator in Menon, but you don't really have physics. But K.C. has really developed in his young mathematicians a taste for mathematical research. He has brought them up in a certain way, he and K.G. Ramanathan. And you have Sheshadri and Narasimhan coming back and again taking over. So you have a very different history of the institute if you were to look at mathematics. Now, if you look at some of the oral histories that I did, this is with Jal Choksi, who talks about K.C.'s leaving, and I am still not sure why he left. I don't know, I failed to interview him because he didn't agree to be interviewed. And we did all kinds of things when I was here, trying to see if he could be convinced, if Professor Raghunathan and I could go, you know, for a conference and then, you know, talk to him. But he just didn't want to. I even did this ploy of finding in the archives a beautiful photograph of KC lighting Nehru's cigarette and sent it to him and said, you know, I found this, I really want to talk to you. There's no answer. So I think this kind of clash of personalities was something that was going on for a long time in the institute. It happens in all institutions. It is not something, I mean, something that we don't discuss, and I think as historian I have to point out that if this was a clash, so was there a clash between KC and Menon, as it was obvious in, you know, the way in which photographs were represented. So if then that is what is happening, then what is that sense of legacy of the institution? The institution doesn't only have one legacy, it doesn't only have Bhabha's legacy, it also has KC's legacy. And this is how it remembers its legacy. So if I look at the 25-year report, which is the FAT report, you'll find it in the library, this is the introduction to the mathematics group, which talks about the institute from its earliest days had some mathematicians on its faculty, some mathematicians. Mathematicians are not named. It was, however, only after Professor K. Chandrasekharan joined the institution in 1949 that serious consideration was given to a plan for organizing a full-fledged school of mathematics for promoting mathematical research at the highest level in fields of current interest. The second part is completely true, that without KC there'd be no school of mathematics. But the first part, some mathematicians, not true. There was F.W. Levy and there was this man, D.D. Kosambi, who worked here for 20 years from 45 to 65. In fact, he's the first appointee by Homi Bhabha. And he is not remembered in that report. And we find a lot about him in the archives. One of the reasons often given in the historical work that is done on Kosambi is that Kosambi spoke against atomic energy at the Rotary Club of Pune. This was not liked by Bhabha and he was out. But look at the date. He speaks in 1960. He leaves TIFR in 65. In 65, his contract is not renewed. He's born in 1909, so he's already quite old. His contract is not renewed. He's not dismissed. That is not true. So what happens? This was also a question I had when I was looking at the archives. And of course, one of the things that I wanted to now point out is as Bhabha was building this institution was seen to be an institute that would have, would do science in proper ways, in the way the international community would respect. Here's a letter from K. Chandrasekharan to Bhabha, dated 1960, which is talking about the biggest mistake Kosambi made, I think, in his life, when he claimed to have solved the Riemann hypothesis. And I think this had sent shockwaves down, you know, the mathematical community, saying, has he really solved it? And if he has, why don't we know about it? What is it that, you know, has happened? Why are we, you know, not talking about it? So he is obviously very, very upset. He says, I had to hang my head down in shame. I'm sorry for the fair name of the institute. I hold my head down in shame. I know what I would have done to a similar person elsewhere in India. I only pray that you take some notice of scientific dishonesty and deal with it in your own way, quietly and effectively. So obviously this is really a shock that this claim has been made. And I think there is a representation after this when Chandrasekharan and Narasimhan and others write a representation to Bhabha, and there's an inquiry, and Carl Siegel and others go through the paper, which was published in the Journal of Agricultural Economics. That also is very strange, that a paper that's supposed to prove the Riemann hypothesis is published in the Indian Journal of Agricultural Economics. And of course they write and say, no, this is not making sense, this is not working. Kosambi later regrets that he does make this claim, but of course by then he's out of this institute. So I think the point I'm trying to make is institutions have different legacies, and one legacy is sometimes forgotten in favor of others. Because if you look at the early history of the institute, Kosambi helps people like Srikantan, who's analyzing, because Kosambi could do statistical analysis very quickly, and he would do the cosmic ray analysis for Srikantan and others. So there would be that kind of camaraderie between them early on. But I think he did, by the time we come, in 4 years' time, he's already moved into his work, his historical work, and he is no longer really engaged with mathematics. He's doing some things, but not the kind of mathematics that TIFR is doing. And TIFR mathematics is it's a hard-won reputation in the 60s. From 49 to 60, 11 years, they've worked and they've got that reputation. And suddenly, this is not what they want to see. So you find that this is let go of. I'm sorry, this is actually the slides I've got here and there. This was what I've talked about earlier. And this is Bhabha's room as we found it when we came into the archives, which was in that foyer. It's no longer there. I think this tulip chair is back in the director's office. And I think a lot of people used to think I was quite weird to go on and on about this chair. I now teach in a design school and I know how important chairs are. Every designer worth their salt has always designed a chair. This is the first tulip chair, the first chair designed by Eurosarian in Switzerland, which is it's a fiberglass chair. And what is even more surprising, it was designed in 55, and we have records in the archive that Bhabha bought it in 55. So it is a certain European Bauhausian sensibility that makes him attracted to these kinds of things. So I wanted to flag that. That was the replica of the office that was made. And I had asked Jha, who had moved the office, that how did he manage that? How did it take so many years? And, I went on to talk about other legacies of the institute, but this was there. No one was talking about it. That room was locked up. And Jha doesn't directly tell me, but he does say that around that time, TIFR got its deemed university status. And there were so many other institutional conflicts. He said, compared to that, moving the office was a breeze. That was not so difficult at all. So you had then this cryptohomi Bhabha that is then designed and put out, out in the foyer. And, you again establish that same, legacy of, Bhabha, this great scientist, and here's his great office. Because there was nothing else. It was, when I saw it, it was just a room with his things in it. It didn't have too many. It needed something else for it to come alive. And if you look at the present exhibition, there again you have a very larger than life Bhabha. There is some attempt within the exhibition to include the life of the institute But I mean, you are the judge to see whether it has been successful, because it looks like it's Bhabha who overwhelms the whole. It is not that institute that he has built. It is not, you know, all the other things that he's done. I want to come now to another point, which I think is important, because this is something that I've always wondered about and talked to some of you about. Bhabha himself tried changing the, you know, administrative structure a little bit to make it a little better, because he said what we have inherited from the British is not a structure that, you know, is viable. So we must change it. But there was very little done to train administrators in the same way that scientific staff and scientists are trained. So very often administrators don't know exactly what the scientists are doing. And, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, differences between them. And towards, in 63, he was interviewed by the International Journal of Science and Technology. And when he was asked what is his most serious problem, he said the serious problem was right administrative setup. He says our administration is not adapted to the requirements of the technological age. We have inherited from the past a very high grade of administrators. In their own line, they are first class. For example, our civil services have been of very high caliber, but the whole background is that of the administration of justice, of law and order, tax collection, or routine administration done in the secretariat. It's not adapted to the administration of laboratories, plants, factories. And this is true even today. I'm sure all of you will agree that, you know, you need some kind of overhaul where there is that kind of, you know, understanding between administrators and scientists. That's R. Narasimhan and Cockcroft, Lady Cockcroft and Bhabha. But this is what he says, that, you know, he talks about Bhabha doing many things and not having an administrative setup that would really help with the institution. And he said, though you cannot blame him, what happens actually is that he doesn't, there's a huge difference between Bhabha and the next level. The next level is his secretary, who is not the same. So he says, you know, there's no intermediate level where there is, you know, some scientist who takes charge of it and is able to take administrative decisions. And he's very accurate about how he, discusses this. And he says, administration at the higher level had become very politicized. There was this difference of opinion between Bhabha and Chandrasekharan, between Chandrasekharan and Menon, and it would have taken a lot of effort and understanding in order to keep all the people equally satisfied, because they all had opinionated views about how things should be. Dr. Bhabha, I think, tried to get around some of these problems by keeping on recruiting new people. And that is, again, I find institutions often do that. That, you know, you throw a few more things into the mix and, you know, you hope things will take care of themselves. But it needs to be addressed, and it seems to be a historical problem. That it's there, it's got a long history. And maybe, you know, I thought by flagging it, you'd be able to understand what you take away from this for the future. And I think this also affected the spirit of doing science. And this is the famous, you know, this is Devendralal's reflections on his famous, very negative speech that he gave at the J.R.D. Tata Memorial Lecture just the year before in 2006. And then when he was talking to me, he says that in this institute, there was that culture of doing things. And people went abroad and did things, but when they came back, they didn't do anything. And that is what I was talking about, you know. And I think he got everyone's hackles up. Everyone was really upset that Devendralal said such a thing. And I felt, when I was looking at all this, that what is it that I'm missing here? Is there some sense of legacy that Lal is also trying to hint at and not articulating? And I realized that what he was hinting at is the fact that Bhabha becomes this figure and you pay lip service to it, but you don't take away lessons from what he stood for. So I'll just end with two people who talk about what they did with this legacy. For Swaroop, it was really building this telescope, this the Uti telescope being built here, was really about extending a certain vision of Bhabha when he looks back at it. He's sort of thinking that, you know, visions of founders should be extended in some sort of way. But here is Siddiqui who did something different. He said, you know, you needed to not just extend the vision, you needed to interpret the vision. You need to reinterpret the vision and take an institution forward. It cannot be stuck with, you know, Bhabha was so great and Bhabha did this. So what he said was really interesting because he says that you acquire strength in areas and take biology forward. That's what he said he'd do in NCBS. And I remember being quite shocked when once I was interviewing him and he said, you know, people want to always create clones of themselves. That's not how an institution will work. You need new people. And you may not understand their science, but they're good in their field. They'll take it forward. You have to have that trust in younger people. And I thought, that is really something, because I've never heard an 80-year-old tell you that. Usually most 80-year-olds, and I speak to a lot of them, 80 to 100 is the age group I speak to, and I've interviewed 300-year-olds. So they'll usually tell you how good their times was and how this generation doesn't understand. Siddiqui, on the other hand, of course, tells me about all the versions of the proposal and what it should do and how, you know, he should set up this institution. So I feel the lesson here is that institutional legacies, there are many of them, but how you interpret them, reinterpret them and take them forward is what lets an institution renew and rebuild its life. And I wanted to end with the work I do now, which is oral history, because I feel it is only through oral history sometimes, through these long interviews I do, that I get to understand institutional culture. And this is what oral historians do. And Alessandro Portelli, who will be teaching at our institute in November, is someone who's one of the finest oral historians of our times. And this is what he says, that we don't have to scrutinize what they're saying, but just open up that space to understand how the past is reconstructed in the present. Thank you. I'm sorry I took longer because I think we took wasted time setting up. Thank you for that question. That's a very important one. And that's something, you know, I also wondered about. But I'll give you a little I mean, it's something I read out yesterday at Homi Bhabha Center, and I'll give you a little surprise here. When Nehru speaks in 62 at the inauguration, you are referring to that brochure which has Nehru's speech. All of us know that. When we were setting up the archives, we actually came across the speech and digitized it. Now, interestingly, that speech doesn't begin in English. That speech begins in Hindi. Nehru is very worried because it is the time, 62, it's Indochina. And this is my translation of the Hindi. And let me read it to you. Lots of people may not know why such an emphasis is being put on science. Why so much money is being spent? Why did I take the trouble to come from Delhi? The big countries, mulks as he says in Hindi, have more power while our country has remained poor. If we wish to empower our country, which is now independent, we have to create a strong base so we can learn the basics. This may not show immediate results, but finally result in the uplift of the country. I'll skip a bit and I'll tell you what he says later. This is key. How have other countries progressed and become more powerful? Because they have paid attention to science. They have discovered new things as a result. But we have only imitated what they are doing and in the end strengthened those countries and not ourselves. We should give ourselves an opportunity to do similar things in our country so we can progress. Our army needs weapons. If we buy weapons from other countries, we are submitting to them. We must make our own. If we have to create something like a factory, we would have to learn by doing. We have to understand the fundamentals of nature. Whether we make a bomb or not, nuclear energy can be useful. This is all in Hindi. Then he laughs and says, I'm sorry, I have to make this speech. So it is interesting that he makes the speech in Hindi. Now after this, he goes to a meeting to support Krishna Menon. Same day. Okay, so you'll find that this is Nehru, whose election meeting. And this is the language. These are not, this Hindi and the language he's using is not something meant for the 12 or 9 Nobel laureates who are sitting there in the audience. He's speaking in Hindi almost as if he's speaking to a popular audience. So I think there was that expectation that fundamental research will finally indirectly lead to, you know, technological improvements. Also, he's saying here weapons. He's talking in a very military term, right? He's not. So, thank you for asking that. Yeah.
This was 62.
62. This is 62. 15 January, 19 January. Yeah.
Ever in your looking through the archives, there was ever a discussion about the fact that a fundamental research institution that had been set up was separated from a university. Student-centric environment. Did that ever come up in discussion? That was one. And the second question I had is that you discussed this mode of recruitment, which gives you flexibility, quote-unquote, to recruit somebody who you believe holds all promise, but also runs the risk on the other side of potentially switching to a very nepotistic model where you recruit more and more people who you think are right because they fall into a community and a feature and an environment that speaks to you but isolates then potentially other people from even being considered for this position. Was there any discussion that reflected on that practice?
Well, in the archives, in fact today we were looking through the, there's quite a bit on, you know, relationship to universities, but I think there is also a very live connection to Bombay University because Bombay University gives the degrees. But there is no discussion on how will we, where will these students come from? What should we do to improve, you know, the kind of students we'll recruit? And of course, it remains isolated for a very long time. Some of the TIFR scientists who moved away from here and who I've interviewed, like Professor Mukunda and others, in fact, talk about that isolation. And they say, you know, that this was one of the problems, that we were not, you know, part of science that was being done elsewhere in India. But what you're saying about this mode of recruitment, I talk about it in the book as using the particular network that he knew so well through Cambridge and Princeton. And this only brings certain people. It also introduces into that network the kind of bias that already exists within it. So for example, there's a little bit about Bibha Chowdhury, the cosmic ray scientist, who was one of the first women to work here, who's not seen as a leader. She's just not seen as a leader, and the correspondence goes on like that. And you can see that this is actually Wilson's bias towards, you know, women scientists. I mean, we all know the story of the DNA, but it is there here, and that carries over here because, you know, that network is the is playing that advisory role. So I think you're right that that mode, on the other hand, mathematics also uses its network, but uses it very differently, because it's not as if it's a known network. It is more, for Casey, it is about, you know, topography, algebraic geometry, where can these kids go and learn this, and he will set up some kind of connection. But it is not, I went to college with you, I went to Cambridge with you, and therefore your student will be here. That is not there. So I think there are different ways in which networks operate, and I've talked about both networks in my book. Yeah. No, go ahead.
It's fascinating that you hone into this difference between the school of mathematics and the school of physics in terms of the nurturing environment and how they because that's a sense that, you know, some of us got as well when we were PhD students here. But I was wondering if you also sensed a difference in governance practice in the two groups in terms of how decisions were taken within the groups, within the schools rather, and about recruitment, promotions, or how to design the student programs or things like that. Did you sense a difference?
Not too much. I mean, it's not as if one was more democratic than the other. But nurture, certainly. Like, for example, Narasimhan talks about how, you know, Casey remains a little distant from the younger lot. It is K.G. Ramanathan who talks to them constantly about, you know, mathematics and what are the interesting problems. But when Narasimhan is invited to give a colloquium at the Zeta Function colloquium, to give a talk, Casey says that you will come to me and present to me first. And I shall then, you know, see, tell you how to do, you know, what you should pay attention to. And he says that was learning. But it's not as if Casey was, you know, friends with the boys. No, it's still that hierarchy is maintained. So both groups have that. So I think, I don't think one is more democratic than the others. Whether about recruitments, I think, you know, it's not very clear to me if that network is very different or, but mathematics, of course, recruits across the board, but so does maybe also physics. Yeah.
Sorry. Come back to this question about fundamental science and applications. In the 80s, there was still a continuing little tension about this, if I remember correctly, because people in computer science, what was then the computer science, some people were and some people were building machines. And there was a little bit of institutional tension about how these should be judged with respect to each other. Mm. And I wonder how far back it goes. What do you find in your thoughts?
You know, I think it does go quite far, because Narasimhan, who makes the TIFRAC, the first computer which is made here in TIFR, he actually goes away because he's not promoted in the way he expects. And then he's brought back when they're buying the CDC 3600 because he knows it, and he comes back from Illinois. And he's at that point, I think the archive has a letter which says that, you know, we offer you this readership. And I've always wondered why that comes so late, because he had already proved himself. He had built the machine and he had made it work. It was working. So, no, these are earlier. Narasimhan comes back in the 60s. Yeah, so I'm saying that it probably is there. And it's there even if you read the history of the Princeton Institute. The computer was seen as this machine, you know, we don't want to see it, we don't want to know it's there. So I think that is very much, you know, von Neumann is seen as someone who's built this machine, and, you know, this is not quite what we do here. So I think if you read Who Got Einstein's Office, which is a history of that institute, you'll find that that is what is happening with
one. There's been a biography written, autobiography written by one of the people.
No. This is an older book. Oh, okay. I see. Okay.
There's a question from Satyanarayan.
Oh, okay.
He couldn't come here. He couldn't be here. But it's sort of in line with how you answered Shudipta.
Okay.
I mean, in answer to that question. So he's asking, was Bhabha thinking about atomic energy and strategic work from the very beginning, or has he extended these areas subsequently?
That's interesting. I feel he extends them pretty soon after the institute starts. So 45, by 48, 49, I mean, Udgaonkar's barely got 3-4 years before he's sent off to Saclay for learning nuclear reactor physics. So I think that's what happens, that it's quite soon. It's not even, the institution is, even before it moves to, or just as it moves to Old York Club in 1949. So I think it is pretty early in the history of the institute.
That's about atomic energy. What about strategic?
Well, I don't know that they were separate, because if you look at the kind of work that, you know, like my interviews with P.K. Iyengar or Raja Ramanna, they all talk about, you know, again, it's atomic energy and their first Pokhran and, you know, things that they do in the 70s, and how there is a certain secrecy around that, certain ways in which they work with the military. And strategy, I think, during Indo-Pak, they are, P.V.S. Rao and others are doing some work for the army. And Bhabha sees that as important. In fact, I think the archives does have certain emergency meetings that are called about how, you know, this work is important. And these would be work that was confidential and, you know, the theoreticians would, you know, theoretical physicists would have a take on it, and they'd say, oh, actually it was nothing. That's why it used to be under cover. And what good strategic thing can we do here anyway? So, but that was a joke. But I think there was some sort of fear. There was a bit of that.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank Indira once again.
Thank you.
And get it signed by you.
Okay. Either enter to Dita Pachinada Chiki at